And what am I supposed to do with these old thighs now? Just walk up and down these rooms? What good are they, Jesus? They will never give me the peace I need to get from sunup to sundown. What good are they? Are you trying to tell me that I'm going to have to go all the way through these days? All the way, oh my God, to that box with four handles, with never, nobody settling down between my legs, even if I sew up those old pillowcases and rinse down the porch and feed my children and beat the rugs and haul the coal up out the bin? Even then, nobody, oh Jesus, I could be a mule or plow the furrows with my hands if need be, or hold these rickety walls up with my back if need be, if I knew that somewhere in this world, in the pocket of some night, I could open my legs to some cowboy lean hips. But you're trying to tell me no. And oh my sweet Jesus, what kind of cross is that? 1939. When the word got out about Eva being put in Sunnydale, the people in the bottom shook their heads and said Sula was a roach. Later, when they saw how she took Jude, then ditched him for others, and heard how he bought a bus ticket to Detroit, where he bought, but never mailed, birthday cards to his sons, they forgot all about Hannah's easy ways, or their own, and said she was a bitch. Everybody remembered the plague of robins that announced her return, and the tale about her watching Hannah burn was stirred up again. But it was the men who gave her the final label, who fingerprinted her for all time. They were the ones who said she was guilty of the unforgivable thing, the thing for which there was no understanding, no excuse, no compassion, the root from which there was no way back, the dirt that could not ever be washed away. They said that Sula slept with white men. It may not have been true, but it certainly could have been. She was obviously capable of it. In any case, all minds were closed to her when that word was passed around. It made the old women draw their lips together, made small children look away from her in shame, made young men fantasize elaborate torture for her just to get the saliva back in their mouths when they saw her. Every one of them imagined the scene, each according to his own predilections. Sula underneath some white man, and it filled them with choking disgust. There was nothing lower she could do, nothing filthier. The fact that their own skin color was proof that it had happened in their own families was no deterrent to their bile. Nor was the willingness of black men to lie in the beds of white women a consideration that might lead them toward tolerance. They insisted that all unions between white men and black women be rape, for a black woman to be willing was literally unthinkable. In that way, they regarded integration with precisely the same venom that white people did. So they laid broomsticks across their doors at night and sprinkled salt on porch steps. But aside from one or two unsuccessful efforts to collect the dust from her footsteps, they did nothing to harm her. As always, the black people looked at evil, stony-eyed, and let it run. Sula acknowledged none of their attempts at counter-conjure or their gossip, and seemed to need the services of nobody. So they watched her far more closely than they watched any other roach or bitch in the town. And their alertness was gratified. Things began to happen. First off, Teapot knocked on her door to see if she had any bottles. He was the 5-year-old son of an indifferent mother, all of whose interests sat around the door of the time-and-a-half pool hall. Her name was Betty, but she was called Teapot's mama because being his mama was precisely her major failure. When Sula said no, the boy turned around and fell down the steps. He couldn't get up right away, and Sula went to help him. His mother, just then tripping home, saw Sula bending over her son's pained face. She flew into a fit of concerned, if drunken, motherhood, and dragged Teapot home. She told everybody that Sula had pushed him, and talked so strongly about it, she was forced to abide by the advice of her friends and take him to the county hospital. The $2 she hated to release turned out to be well spent, for Teapot did have a fracture, although the doctor said poor diet had contributed substantially to the daintiness of his bones. Teapot's mama got a lot of attention anyway, and immersed herself in a role she had shown no inclination for, motherhood. The very idea of a grown woman hurting her boy kept her teeth on edge. She became the most devoted mother, sober, clean, and industrious. No more nickels for Teapot to go to Dick's for a breakfast of Mr. Goodbars and soda pop. No more long hours of him alone or wandering the roads while she was otherwise engaged. Her change was a distinct improvement, although little Teapot did miss those quiet times at Dick's. Other things happened. Mr. Finley sat on his porch, sucking chicken bones, as he had done for 13 years, looked up, saw Sula, choked on a bone, and died on the spot. That incident and Teapot's mama cleared up for everybody the meaning of the birthmark over her eye. It was not a stemmed rose or a snake. It was Hannah's ashes marking her from the very beginning. She came to their church suppers without underwear, bought their steaming platters of food, and merely picked at it, relishing nothing, exclaiming over no one's ribs or cobbler. They believed that she was laughing at their God. And the fury she created in the women of the town was incredible, for she would lay their husbands once and then no more. Hannah had been a nuisance, but she was complimenting the women in a way by wanting their husbands. Sula was trying them out and discarding them without any excuse the men could swallow. So the women, to justify their own judgment, cherished their men more, soothed the pride and vanity Sula had bruised. Among the weighty evidence piling up was the fact that Sula did not look her age. She was near 30, and unlike them, had lost no teeth, suffered no bruises, developed no ring of fat at the waist or pocket at the back of her neck. It was rumored that she had had no childhood diseases, was never known to have chicken pox, croup, or even a runny nose. She had played rough as a child. Where were the scars? Except for a funny-shaped finger and that evil birthmark, she was free of any normal signs of vulnerability. Some of the men who as boys had dated her remembered that on picnics, neither gnats nor mosquitoes would settle on her. Patsy, Hannah's one-time friend, agreed and said not only that, but she had witnessed the fact that when Sula drank beer, she never belched. The most damning evidence, however, came from Desi, who was a big daughter elk and knew things. At one of the social meetings, she revealed something to her friends. Yeah, well, I noticed something long time ago. Ain't said nothing about it because I wasn't sure what it meant. Well, I did mention it to Ivy, but not nobody else. I just remember how long ago, about a month or two, I guess, because I hadn't put down my new linoleum yet. Did you see it, Cora? It's that kind we saw in the catalog? No. Get on with it, Desi. Well, Cora was with me when we looked in the catalog. We all know about your linoleum. What we don't know is... Okay, let me tell it, will you? Just before the linoleum came, I was out front and seed Shadrach carrying on as usual, up by the well, walking around it, saluting and carrying on, you know how he does, hollering commands and, will you get on with it? Who's telling this, me or you? You. Well, let me tell it then. Like I say, he was just cutting up as usual when Miss Sula Mae walks by on the other side of the road. And quick as that, she snapped her fingers. He stopped and cut on over across the road, stepping over to her like a tall turkey in short corn. And guess what? He tips his hat. Shadrach don't wear no hat. I note that, but he tipped it anyway. You know what I mean? He acted like he had a hat and reached up for it and tipped it at her. Now you know, Shadrach ain't civil to nobody. Sure ain't. Even when you buying his fish, he cussin'. If you ain't got the right change, he cussin' you. If you act like a fish ain't too fresh, he snatch it out of your hand like he doing you the favor. Well, everybody know he's a reprobate. Yeah. So, how come he tip his hat to Sula? How come he don't cuss her? Two devils? Exactly. What'd she do when he tipped it? Smile and give him a curtsy? No, and that was the other thing. It was the first time I see her look anything but hateful. Like she's smelling you with her eyes and don't like your soap. When he tipped his hat, she put her hand on her throat for a minute and cut out. Went running on up the road to home. And him still standing there, tipping away. And this is the point I was coming to. When I went back in the house, a big sty come on my eye. And I ain't never had no sty before. Never. That's 'cause you saw it. Exactly. Devil all right. No two ways about it, Dessie said. And she popped the rubber band off the deck of cards to settle them down for a nice, long game of bidwiss. Their conviction of Sula's evil changed them in accountable yet mysterious ways. Once the source of their personal misfortune was identified, they had leave to protect and love one another. They began to cherish their husbands and wives, protect their children, repair their homes, and in general band together against the devil in their midst. In their world, aberrations were as much a part of nature as grace. It was not for them to expel or annihilate it. They would no more run Sula out of town than they would kill the robins that brought her back. For in their secret awareness of him, he was not the god of three faces they sang about. They knew quite well that he had four, and that the fourth explained Sula. They had lived with various forms of evil all their days, and it wasn't that they believed God would take care of them. It was rather that they knew God had a brother, and that brother hadn't spared God's son, so... why should he spare them? There was no creature so ungodly as to make them destroy it. They could kill easily if provoked to anger, but not by design, which explained why they could not mob kill anyone. To do so was not only unnatural, it was undignified. The presence of evil was something to be first recognized, then dealt with, survived, outwitted, triumphed over. Their evidence against Sula was contrived, but their conclusions about her were not. Sula was distinctly different. Eva's arrogance and Hannah's self-indulgence merged in her. And with a twist that was all her own imagination, she lived out her days exploring her own thoughts and emotions, giving them full rein, feeling no obligation to please anybody, unless their pleasure pleased her. as willing to feel pain as to give pain, to feel pleasure as to give pleasure. Hers was an experimental life, ever since her mother's remarks sent her flying up those stairs, ever since her one major feeling of responsibility had been exercised on the bank of a river with a closed place in the middle. The first experience taught her there was no other that you could count on. The second, that there was no self to count on either. She had no center, no speck around which to grow. In the midst of a pleasant conversation with someone, she might say, "Why do you chew with your mouth open?" Not because the answer interested her, but because she wanted to see the person's face change rapidly. She was completely free of ambition, with no affection for money, property, or things, no greed, no desire to command attention or compliments, no ego. For that reason, she felt no compulsion to verify herself, be consistent with herself. She had clung to Nell as the closest thing to both an other and a self, only to discover that she and Nell were not one and the same thing. She had no thought at all of causing Nell pain when she bedded down with Jude. They had always shared the affection of other people, compared how a boy kissed, what line he used with one and then the other. Marriage, apparently, had changed all that, but having had no intimate knowledge of marriage, having lived in a house with women who thought all men available, and selected from among them with a care only for their tastes, she was ill-prepared for the possessiveness of the one person she felt close to. She knew well enough what other women said and felt, or said they felt, but she and Nell had always seen through them. They both knew that those women were not jealous of other women, that they were only afraid of losing their jobs, afraid their husbands would discover that no uniqueness lay between their legs. Nell was the one person who had wanted nothing from her, who had accepted all aspects of her. Now she wanted everything, and all because of that. Nell was the first person who had been real to her, whose name she knew, who had seen, as she had, the slant of life that made it possible to stretch it to its limits. Now Nell was one of them, one of the spiders, whose only thought was the next rung of the web, who dangled in dark, dry places, suspended by their own spittle, more terrified of the free fall than the snake's breath below. Their eyes so intent on the wayward stranger who trips into their net, they were blind to the cobalt on their own backs, the moonshine. The snake's breath, however fatal, they were merely victims and knew how to behave in that role, just as Nell knew how to behave as the wronged wife. But the free fall, oh no, that required, demanded, invention. A thing to do with the wings, a way of holding the legs, and most of all, a full surrender to the downward flight, if they wished to taste their tongues or stay alive. But alive was what they and now Nell did not want to be. Too dangerous. Now Nell belonged to the town and all of its ways. She had given herself over to them, and the flick of their tongues would drive her back into her little dry corner, where she would cling to her spittle, high above the breath of the snake and the fall. It had surprised her a little, and saddened her a good deal, when Nell behaved the way the others would have. Nell was one of the reasons she had drifted back to Medallion, that and the boredom she found in Nashville, Detroit, New Orleans, New York, Philadelphia, Macon, and San Diego. All those cities held the same people, working the same mouths, sweating the same sweat, The men who took her to one or another of those places had merged into one large personality. The same language of love, the same entertainments of love, the same cooling of love. Whenever she introduced her private thoughts into their rubbings or goings, they hooded their eyes. They taught her nothing but love tricks, shared nothing but worry, gave nothing but money. She had been looking all along for a friend, and it took her a while to discover that a lover was not a comrade and never could be for a woman, and that no one would ever be that version of herself which she sought to reach out to and touch with an ungloved hand. There was only her own mood and whim, and if that was all there was, she decided to turn the naked hand toward it, discover it, and let others become as intimate with their own selves as she was. In a way, her strangeness, her naivete, her craving for the other half of her equation was the consequence of an idle imagination. Had she paints or clay, or knew the discipline of the dance or strings, had she anything to engage her tremendous curiosity and her gift for metaphor, she might have exchanged the restlessness and preoccupation with whim for an activity that provided her with all she yearned for. And like any artist with no art form, she became dangerous. She had lied only once in her life to Nell about the reason for putting Eva out, and she could lie to her only because she cared about her. When she'd come back home, social conversation was impossible for her because she could not lie. She could not say to those old acquaintances, "Hey, girl, you're looking good," when she saw how the years had dusted their bronze with ash, the eyes that had once opened wide to the moon bent into grimy sickles of concern. The narrower their lives, the wider their hips. Those with husbands had folded themselves into starched coffins, their sides bursting with other people's skinned dreams and bony regrets. Those without men were like sour-tipped needles featuring one constant empty eye. Those with men had had the sweetness sucked from their breath by ovens and steam kettles. Their children were like distant but exposed wounds whose aches were no less intimate because separate from their flesh. They had looked at the world and back at their children, back at the world and back again at their children, and Sula knew that one clear young eye was all that kept the knife away from the throat's curve. She was pariah then and knew it. Knew that they despised her, and believed that they framed their hatred as disgust for the easy way she lay with men, which was true. She went to bed with men as frequently as she could. It was the only place where she could find what she was looking for, misery and the ability to feel deep sorrow. She had not always been aware that it was sadness that she yearned for. Lovemaking seemed to her at first the creation of a special kind of joy. She thought she liked the sootiness of sex and its comedy. She laughed a great deal during the raucous beginnings and rejected those lovers who regarded sex as healthy or beautiful. Sexual aesthetics bored her. Although she did not regard sex as ugly, ugliness was boring also. She liked to think of it as wicked. But as her experiences multiplied, she realized that not only was it not wicked, it was not necessary for her to conjure up the idea of wickedness in order to participate fully. During the lovemaking, she found and needed to find the cutting edge. When she left off, cooperating with her body and began to assert herself in the act. Particles of strength gathered in her, like steel shavings drawn to a spacious magnetic center, forming a tight cluster that nothing, it seemed, could break. And there was utmost irony and outrage in lying under someone in a position of surrender, feeling her own abiding strength and limitless power. But the cluster did break, fall apart, and in her panic to hold it together, she leaped from the edge into soundlessness and went down howling in a stinging awareness of the endings of things, an eye of sorrow in the midst of all that hurricane rage of joy. There, in the center of that silence, was not eternity, but the death of time, and a loneliness so profound the word itself had no meaning. For loneliness assumed the absence of other people, and the solitude she found in that desperate terrain had never admitted the possibility of other people. She wept then, tears for the deaths of the littlest things, the castaway shoes of children, broken stems of marsh grass, battered and drowned by the sea, prom photographs of dead women she never knew, wedding rings in pawn shop windows, the tidy bodies of Cornish hens in a nest of rice. When her partner disengaged himself, she looked up at him in wonder, trying to recall his name, and he looked down at her, smiling with tender understanding of the state of tearful gratitude to which he believed he had brought her. She waited impatiently for him to turn away and settle into a wet skim of satisfaction and light disgust, leaving her to the post-coital privateness in which she met herself, welcomed herself, and joined herself in matchless harmony. At 29, she knew it would be no other way for her, but she had not counted on the footsteps on the porch and the beautiful black face that stared at her through the blue glass window. Ajax, looking for all the world as he had 17 years ago when he had called her pig meat. He was 21 then, she 12, a universe of time between them. Now she was 29, he 38, and the lemon-yellow haunches seemed not so far away after all. She opened the heavy door and saw him standing on the other side of the screen door with 2 quarts of milk tucked into his arms like marble statues. He smiled and said, "I've been looking all over for you." "Why?" she asked. "To give you these." He nodded toward one of the quarts of milk. "I don't like milk," she said. "But you like bottles, don't you?" He held one up. "Ain't that pretty?" And indeed it was. Hanging from his fingers, framed by a slick blue sky, it looked precious and clean and permanent. She had the distinct impression that he had done something dangerous to get them. Sula ran her fingernails over the screen thoughtfully for a second, and then laughing, she opened the screen door. Ajax came in and headed straight for the kitchen. Sula followed slowly. By the time she got to the door, he had undone the complicated wire cap and was letting the cold milk run into his mouth. Sula watched him, or rather the rhythm in his throat, with growing interest. When he had had enough, he poured the rest into the sink, rinsed the bottle out, and presented it to her. She took the bottle with one hand and his wrist with the other and pulled him into the pantry. There was no need to go there, for not a soul was in the house, but the gesture came to Hannah's daughter naturally. There in the pantry, empty now of flour sacks, void of row upon row of canned goods, free forever of strings of tiny green peppers, holding the wet milk bottle tight in her arm, she stood wide-legged against the wall and pulled from his track-lean hips all the pleasure her thighs could hold. He came regularly then, bearing gifts, clusters of blackberries still on their branches, 4 meal-fried porgies wrapped in a salmon-colored sheet of the Pittsburgh Courier, 1 handful of jacks, 2 boxes of lime gel-well, 1 hunk of ice wagon ice, 1 can of old Dutch cleanser with the bonneted woman chasing dirt with her stick, 1 page of Tilly the Toiler comics, and more gleaming white bottles of milk. Contrary to what anybody would have suspected from just seeing him lounging around the pool hall, or shooting at Mr. Fenley for beating his own dog, or calling filthy compliments to passing women, Ajax was very nice to women. His women, of course, knew it, and it provoked them into murderous battles over him in the streets. Brawling, thick-thighed women with knives disturbed many a Friday night with their bloodletting and attracted whooping crowds. On such occasions, Ajax stood along with the crowd and viewed the fighters with the same golden-eyed indifference with which he watched old men playing checkers. Other than his mother, who sat in her shack with 6 younger sons working roots, he had never met an interesting woman in his life. His kindness to them in general was not due to a ritual of seduction. He had no need for it, but rather to the habit he acquired in dealing with his mother, who inspired thoughtfulness and generosity in all her sons. She was an evil country woman, blessed with 7 adoring children, whose joy it was to bring her the plants, hair, underclothing, fingernail parings, white hens, blood, camphor, pictures, kerosene, and footstep dust that she needed, as well as to order Van Van, High John the Conqueror, Little John to Chew, Devil's Shoestring, Chinese Wash, Mustard Seed, and the 9 herbs from Cincinnati. She knew about the weather, omens, the living, the dead, dreams, and all illnesses, and made a modest living with her skills. Had she any teeth, or ever straightened her back, she would have been the most gorgeous thing alive, worthy of her son's worship for her beauty alone, if not for the absolute freedom she allowed them, known in some quarters as neglect, and the weight of her hoary knowledge. This woman Ajax loved, and after her, airplanes. There was nothing in between. And when he was not sitting enchanted, listening to his mother's words, he thought of airplanes and pilots and the deep sky that held them both. People thought that those long trips he took to large cities in the state were for some sophisticated good times they could not imagine, but only envy. Actually, he was leaning against the barbed wire of airports or nosing around hangars just to hear the talk of the men who were fortunate enough to be in the trade. The rest of the time he was not watching his mother's magic or thinking of airplanes, he spent in the idle pursuits of bachelors without work in small towns. He had heard all the stories about Sula, and they aroused his curiosity. Her elusiveness and indifference to established habits of behavior reminded him of his mother, who was as stubborn in her pursuits of the occult as the women of Greater St. Matthew's were in the search for redeeming grace. So when his curiosity was high enough, he picked 2 bottles of milk off the porch of some white family and went to see her, suspecting that this was perhaps the only other woman he knew whose life was her own, who could deal with life efficiently, and who was not interested in nailing him. Sula, too, was curious, She knew nothing about him, except the word he had called out to her years ago, and the feeling he had excited in her then. She had grown quite accustomed to the clichés of other people's lives, as well as her own increasing dissatisfaction with Medallion. If she could have thought of a place to go, she probably would have left. But that was before Ajax looked at her through the blue glass and held the milk aloft like a trophy. But it was not the presence that made her wrap him up in her thighs. They were charming, of course, especially the jar of butterflies he let loose in the bedroom. But her real pleasure was the fact that he talked to her. They had genuine conversations. He didn't speak down to her or at her, nor content himself with puerile questions about her life or monologues of his own activities. Thinking she was possibly brilliant, like his mother, he seemed to expect brilliance from her, and she delivered. And in all of it, he listened more than he spoke. His clear comfort at being in her presence, his lazy willingness to tell her all about fixes and the powers of plants, his refusal to baby or protect her, his assumption that she was both tough and wise, all of that, coupled with a wide generosity of spirit, only occasionally erupting into vengeance, sustained Sula's interest and enthusiasm. His idea of bliss on earth as opposed to bliss in the sky was a long bath in piping hot water, his head on the cool white rim, his eyes closed in reverie. Soaking in hot water give you a bad back? Sula stood in the doorway, looking at his knees, glistening just at the surface of the soap-gray water. Soaking in Sula give me a bad back. Worth it? Don't know yet. Go away. Airplanes? Airplanes. Lindbergh know about you. Go away. She went and waited for him in Eva's high bed, her head turned to the boarded-up window. She was smiling, thinking how like Jude's was his craving to do the white man's work. When two Deweys came in with their beautiful teeth and said, "We sick." Sula turned her head slowly and murmured, "Get well. We need some medicine. Look in the bathroom. Ajax in there. Then wait. We sick now." Sula leaned over the bed, picked up a shoe, and threw it at them. "Cocksucker," they screamed, and she leaped out of the bed, naked as a yard dog. She caught the red-headed Dewey by his shirt and held him by the heels over the banister until he wet his pants. The other Dewey was joined by the third, and they delved into their pockets for stones, which they threw at her. Sula, ducking and tottering with laughter, carried the wet Dewey to the bedroom, and when the other two followed her, deprived of all weapons except their teeth, Sula had dropped the first Dewey on the bed and was fishing in her purse. She gave each of them a dollar bill, which they snatched, and then scooted off down the stairs to Dick's to buy the catarrh remedy they loved to drink. Ajax came sopping wet into the room and lay down on the bed to let the air dry him. They were both still for a long time, until he reached out and touched her arm. He liked for her to mount him so he could see her towering above him and call soft obscenities up into her face. As she rocked there, swayed there, like a Georgia pine on its knees, high above the slipping, falling smile, high above the golden eyes and the velvet helmet of hair, rocking, swaying, she focused her thoughts to bar the creeping disorder that was flooding her hips. She looked down, down from what seemed an awful height, at the head of the man whose lemon-yellow gabardines had been the first sexual excitement she'd known, letting her thoughts dwell on his face in order to confine, for just a while longer, the drift of her flesh toward the high silence of orgasm. If I take a chamois and rub real hard on the bone, right on the ledge of your cheekbone, some of the black will disappear. It will flake away into the chamois, and underneath there will be gold leaf. I can see it shining through the black. I know it is there. How high she was over his wand lean body. How slippery was his sliding smile. And if I take a nail file, or even Eva's old paring knife, that will do, and scrape away at the gold, it will fall away, and there will be alabaster. The alabaster is what gives your face its planes, its curves. That is why your mouth smiling does not reach your eyes. Alabaster is giving it a gravity that resists a total smile. The height and the swaying dizzied her, so she bent down and let her breasts graze his chest. Then I can take a chisel and small tap hammer and tap away at the alabaster. It will crack then, like ice under the pick. And through the breaks, I will see the loam, fertile, free of pebbles and twigs, for it is the loam that is giving you that smell. She slipped her hands under his armpits, for it seemed as though she would not be able to dam the spread of weakness she felt under her skin without holding on to something. I will put my hand deep into your soil, lift it, sift it with my fingers, feel its warm surface and dewy chill below. She put her head under his chin with no hope in the world of keeping anything at all at bay. I will water your soil, keep it rich and moist. But how much? How much water to keep the loam moist? And how much loam will I need to keep my water still? And when do the two make mud? He swallowed her mouth, just as her thighs had swallowed his genitals, and the house was very, very quiet.